In the year 1190, just 19 years after the massacre in Blois in France that was the subject of my previous presentation, another tragedy struck, this time across the channel in England, in the northeastern town of York. York is about 170 miles north of London. As is generally the case, a number of factors were responsible. Growing anti-Jewish sentiment in previous decades had led to riots against Jews in a number of different cities in England and already a number of Jewish deaths. The absence of leading royal and religious authorities who were out of the country, they would normally be in a position to try to protect the Jews, and they were absent. General political instability, crusading zeal, religious, economic, and social tensions, all of them converged to provide the background for the massacre of the Jews in York in March of 1190. The most informative sources that we have are Christian chroniclers, most prominently William of Newbury, who wrote an unusually detailed account of the massacre shortly after it occurred. In addition, like we saw earlier in the case of the Blois massacre, Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn, in his Book of Memory, Sefer Zechira, also makes reference to this event. And, as we've seen also in the case of the Blois massacre, it is the subject of a number of Hebrew elegies or keynote. The story began with a number of attackers breaking into the house of a prominent York Jew, killing everyone who lived in it, taking its possessions, and setting the house on fire. Seeing what emerged, seeing what was happening, the rest of the York Jews sought protection for themselves and their valuables in the castle of the local authority. A couple of days later, a second attack, a second house, followed by sustained rioting and plundering. Shortly thereafter, the castle was attacked, and the Jews inside fought for days to defend themselves. Just want to stop here for a second to point out that this notion that Jews were passive, and since the Bar Kokhba revolt of the second century and the IDF of the 20th century, Jews just sat there with folded hands, is simply not true. Whenever they had the opportunity, they did fight and fight with whatever they had to fight with. The issue was that they were generally unable to access any kind of serious implements of war. And so, regretfully, they were most often the victims. But when they could, they did. And here's an example, and we'll come back to this also in the next presentation, presentation number 6. However, the end was near. On March 16th, formidable machines were moved into position in front of the castle, and it became clear to both the Christians and the Jews that now it was only a matter of time. Present in the castle at that time was the head of the community, a prominent rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yom Tov, who had recently arrived from France. He was one of the students of Rabbi Jacob Tam, Rabbeinu Tam, whom we encountered in the previous session, who was the one who allegedly established the fast day in the wake of the Blois massacres in 1171. Both William of Newbury and Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn report that Rabbi Yom Tov called on his co-religionists who were stuck with him in the castle, and it's only a matter of time before the Christian York inhabitants were going to stormed the castle, called on the Jews with him to commit murder, to murder one another, and to commit suicide and to kill themselves. Shocking as this is, certainly to the modern ear, we've already encountered this. This was a significant part of the Jewish experience. We saw it during the Crusades, that out of fear of falling into the hands of Christians, out of fear of God forbid, being tempted to convert to Christianity. So the best thing is we will do an act of, in Hebrew, Kiddush Hashem. We will sanctify God's name. Please turn to text number one. Text number one is William of Newbury's Chronicle. We'll start in the middle of, it's page 123 in the Joseph Jacobs book. I didn't mention this before, but at the first page of every single handout that I give you is a bibliography of sources that I used, both primary and secondary, to put together these presentations. And they're certainly there for you to follow up if anything is of particular interest. I want to bring you into my laboratory and give you a chance to access the material that I accessed for further information. A couple of lines down on page 123 in Jacobs, the tower was stoutly besieged for several days, and at length the machines which had been prepared for the purpose were brought into position. Next page. First paragraph, first full paragraph. When the machines were thus moved into position, the taking of the tower became certain, and it was no longer doubtful that the fatal hour was nearing for the besieged. On the following night, the besiegers were quiet, rejoicing in the certainty of their approaching victory. But the Jews, who were inside, and this is a Christian chronicler describing this, the Jews were brave and braced up by their very despair, had little rest, discussing what they should do in such an extremity. There was a certain old man, a most famous doctor of law, a great rabbi who had recently come to England, and he told them the following. God orders us to die now for the law, and behold, our death is at the door. Skip a few lines. Since then, we ought to prefer a most glorious death to this, to a very dishonest life. I mean, for us to live now would mean that we would have to be able to convert to Christianity. That's the only option that we have, and that's not an option. So a glorious death is a better option. We ought to select the easiest and most honorable form of death. For if we fall into the hands of the enemy, we shall die at their will and amidst their jeers. And so since the life which the Creator gave us, he now demands back from us, let us willingly and devoutly render it up to him with our own hands. And what continues is a whole story about what he said and a whole story about what they did. Turn to page 127. It's the right side in Jacobs. In the middle of that page, indeed, the fury of rational beings against themselves seems stupendous, nay, irrational. He tells this whole story, and I just described a story about suicide and a story about murder. And this is very hard to imagine. It's very hard to internalize. He calls it stupendous and irrational. It is stupendous and irrational. But he who reads the history of Josephus about the Jewish war knows well enough from the ancient superstition of the Jews that madness had lasted down to our days if perchance any sad occasion arises. But well, there's a precedent. He knew his Josephus, and you know that Josephus tells a story about an event that happened way, way early on the top of a big, tall mountain somewhere in the south of Israel called Masada, when Jews, according to Josephus, also engaged in this kind of a self-immolation. And so he's accessing Josephus and using that as a model to try to help explain what is going on here. Now, Newbery's account, William of Newbery's account, is full of specific details which he could not possibly have known. After all, he was not present. He quotes a speech that the rabbi gives, and how does he know word for word the speech that the rabbi gives? He's not there. Already at the end of the 19th century, one scholar noted that William was, quote, apt to give the reins to his imagination and sometimes to draw from the stores of his historical knowledge in order to heighten the interest of his own pages. Now, we moderns are very sensitive to, you can't quote somebody and put it in quotes unless that's exactly what they said. In pre-modern times, they weren't so concerned about that, certainly going back to ancient Roman historians. The way they told the story was to put words into the mouths of the people, the protagonists in the story that they wanted to convey. So we're a little bit more of a stickler about this. They were less, and certainly William of Newbury had no problem in using his imagination to tell what must have happened. Well, based on the fact that I know that this is a propensity within the Jewish community and people, so that's probably what happened now, even though I can't say 100%, but I'm prepared to assert that that is exactly what occurred. Whether or not these specific words were mentioned, it's clear, and everybody agrees, all sources agree, that this mass self-destruction occurred. But there were some Jews who slipped away, who survived, who were not prepared to do this, and they offered to convert to Christianity. I mean, that was generally the option. You convert and you'll be saved. If you don't convert, then you won't be saved. But what happened was that the fury of the mob was so intense that when they came out of the castle with the intention of converting, the mob fell upon them and attacked them and immediately butchered them. Now, the number of victims in the York massacre is hard to know. Numbers are always very hard to know. Some suggest even up to 2,000. I think it's a wild exaggeration. Ephraim of Bonn related that about 150 Jews were slain by others or by themselves, which is a much more likely number. Turn to text number 2. This is an English translation of a little piece of Ephraim of Bonn's chronicle description of the massacre at York. Refers to it, the English transliteration is Evorik. Evorik is some kind of a mixed up Hebrew for York in English. And it occurred on the great Sabbath before Passover, and the season of the miracle was changed to disaster and punishment. We'll come back to this in a moment, the date in March when this massacre occurred. This massacre was extremely, extremely well known, but the site where it occurred remained unmarked until relatively recently, till October 31st, 1978, when a ceremony that was initiated by the Jewish Historical Society of England was held at what is known as Clifford's Tower, which is a place either on or near where that castle was. And a memorial plaque was unveiled in the presence of the Archbishop and Lord Mayor of York and the then Chief Rabbi of England, Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz. Text number 3 is the cover page of this booklet. It's about an 80-page booklet that was published in connection with this unveiling ceremony. Great significance was accorded to this massacre. One historian labeled it the most notorious anti-Jewish atrocity in English history. You know, we're sort of inured against numbers. You know, we are living in the 20th century where numbers that we've encountered are just enormous. So here we're talking about 31, 32, 33 Jews in Blois. We're talking about 150 Jews in York. This is a big deal. And another historian writes, a blacker page in English history than this, I do not know. There are also reports that a ban, in Hebrew, a cherem, was promulgated against ever staying over in the city of York. I recently read a report about a rabbi who was head of a yeshiva in Gateshead. Gateshead is a town north of York. And I read how he would travel from London to Gateshead by train regularly. And he would always tell his students who were accompanying him that if I'm sleeping when we get to York, wake me up, because according to Jewish tradition, you can't sleep in York. You can't be in York. You can't rest in York. So I have to go through York to get to my yeshiva, but I can't fall asleep. I can't be sleeping when we're in York. So it gives you a sense. This is 10, 15, 20 years ago. This is 1190. There is a tradition. You can't be in York. To such an extent is this tragedy considered to be so significant. But yet, no fast day was established. And I'm wondering, why was there no fast day established? Now, one can say, Well, maybe it's the Kalonymos paradigm, right? By now already, I think I could speak a little bit in shorthand, right? So just to review, the Kalonymos paradigm, which we saw in the context of the First Crusade, says, Ein lehosif mo'ed shever v'tavera. We don't add new days. We're going to commemorate the Crusades on the 9th of Av, even though we know that it happened on the 8th of Iyar, or the 23rd of Iyar, or the 1st of Sivan, or the 3rd of Sivan. We know it happened on another day, but we don't add days. So is this reaction to the York massacre an expression of, well, you know, we don't do any other days. We just do one day, and we're going to do it on Tisha B'Av. So I don't think so, because there is no evidence anywhere whatsoever that any kind of a commemorative anything was established in the wake of York. We don't see that anywhere. And I suspect that it has something to do with something else entirely. And I already gave you a little bit of a hint when I read Ephraim of Bonn. And that is, there's a new consideration, and that is, when did the tragedy occur? What's the date that the tragedy occurred? And we're going to see this again very powerfully the end of this presentation in the context of the reaction to the Spanish expulsion in 1492. So when did it happen? The York massacre occurred, it was Friday, March 16. Friday, March 16 is the day before Saturday, Shabbat, March 17. March 17, 1190 was, as we've seen, Shabbat HaGadol. It was the Sabbath before Passover. So I'm not going to fast on that day. It's a festive day. It's a Shabbat. And even if it doesn't fall on a Shabbat, it's right before Passover. I can't fast then. So sometimes, and there's precedent for this, as we'll see, the determination of whether or not there's going to be some kind of a commemorative fast is totally irrelevant to the larger question of, well, Kalonymos said no fasts, and Blois, 20th of Sivan, says yes, fast. But it has something to do with something else entirely, and that is, exactly when did the fast occur? So I think, as significant as York was, and I read to you the assessment of a number of historians who say that this is, oh my God, this is the worst thing that ever happened to British Jewry or English Jewry, there is no commemorative fast, and it's not because we necessarily follow the Kalonymos paradigm. As a matter of fact, we will see, this is now the fifth of our eight presentations, that the Jewish historical verdict was not pretty much to follow the Kalonymos paradigm, but where events happened that required fast days were established. We already saw, even in the case of the Crusades, that the Kalonymos paradigm we defined as a national paradigm. But even right there and right then, local fast days were established. So there's a whole range of fast days that continue to be established. None was established even in York, for York, near York, by York, for anybody else in the area, in England, anywhere. And I think it has to do with the fact of the time when that event occurred. I want to now move to another tragic event. I want to cover four events in this lecture. The second one is 1242. So we move from 1190 to 1242. And in 1242, lo and behold, a new fast day is established. Before we get to 1242, a little bit of a word of background. Ever since the founding of Christianity, the Hebrew Bible was the text that served as the locus for polemics and disputations between Jews and Christians. Christians considered the Hebrew Bible as part of the Holy Scripture. They renamed it the Old Testament, which predates for them what they call the New Testament. So for them, it's part of Holy Scripture. And from its beginnings, a fundamental feature of Christianity was to claim that the Old Testament contains hints for Christianity. Technical term, mystically prefigures Christianity. Now, it's obvious that the literal interpretation of any verse in the Old Testament cannot refer to Christianity, because Christianity came later, after the closing of the biblical canon. So historically, it can't refer specifically, or in Hebrew, the pshat, the literal meaning, can't be Christianity. But if you read it well, and if you put on your right glasses and you ferret out the verse, you'll see that embedded in the text, God put in here events and stories and formulations and ideas that mystically prefigure. If you read it correctly, you'll see already Christianity is in here, even in the Old Testament. For example, I'll give you two examples, and I'll do them very quickly. Now in text number four. One of the most famous examples is the beginning of Genesis. Obviously, the beginning of Genesis 25, there is no Christianity yet. We're talking here about Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac and Rebekah have no children. They pray to God. Rebekah becomes pregnant. And lo and behold, she becomes pregnant with twins. In text number four, Genesis 25, and they struggle with one another. And she doesn't understand, why am I having such a difficult pregnancy? And in verse 23, in response to her question, God says, two nations are in thy womb, and two peoples shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people will be stronger than the other. And here comes the part that is of interest to me, and the elder shall serve the younger. So understand that this it's not just two beings that are now vying with one another, but this represents a whole huge cataclysm that is going to unfold over the course of human history. And sure enough, verse 25, the first one is Esau, and the second one is Jacob. What's the relationship between Esau and Jacob? Esau is the elder, and Jacob is the younger. The elder shall serve the younger. Now, the phrase, the elder shall serve the younger, was understood by the church in a very Christian way. What is the elder? The elder is Jews or Judaism. What is the younger? The younger is Christianity. So they took this verse, which in its literal meaning means the elder shall serve the younger, in the case that Esau will serve Jacob, and they took it to mean the elder shall serve the younger, the elder being the Jews, shall serve the Christians. So here, if you read it with your Christian glasses, you recognize and you understand that this is already a mystical prefiguration for Christianity. Another example, and I'm even going to go so far as to say a most shocking example, is if I were to ask you which single most verse in the Bible represents the unity of God. Where in the Bible do we see that God is one? The one verse more than any other verse. So the response would be, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That is like the paradigmatic classical verse. Christianity says, wait a minute, the whole Christian theology is embedded precisely in this verse. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, your God, the Lord is one. In the verse of Shema Yisrael, the paradigmatic verse for the unity of God, lies the Trinitarian doctrine. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, your God, the Lord, 1, 2, 3, is one. There you have it. The whole Trinitarian doctrine is mystically prefigured in this one verse that Jews have always understood to be the verse that reflects specifically the unity of God. And it turns out that it's not so simple. It's a little bit complicated. The Lord is there three times, and then it's one, and that's precisely the Trinitarian doctrine. It's one, it's three, but it's not really three separate because it's really part of one, but it doesn't coalesce into one because it retains three separate identities. The whole complexity of the Trinitarian doctrine lies in this verse. So the battleground for centuries was the Bible. In the 12th century, something changed, and the church began to turn its attention to the Talmud as the locus for polemic and disputation. The direction was fueled and was driven by apostates. Apostates are those Jews who converted to Christianity and who wanted to impress upon their new co-religionists, their Christian co-religionists, their great zeal. And with a vengeance, they went against those members of their former religion. In 1236, an apostate by the name of Nicholas Donin submitted a memorandum to the Pope in which he charged the Talmud of being guilty of 35 egregious statements. Talmud contains attacks against Christianity. The Talmud contains attacks against non-Jews. The Talmud contains blasphemies against Jesus and against Mary. There's a list of 35 terrible things that are included in the Talmud, and therefore you, Pope, need to take a look at this, and you, Pope, need to go after not only the Jews, but you need to go after the Talmud. The Pope took it seriously. There was a public disputation, a very famous public disputation. Nicholas Donen, former Jew, now Christian, represents the church, and Rabbi Yechiel, who was head of a yeshiva in Paris, represents the Jews. And this disputation takes place in Paris in June of 1240. The Talmud is put on trial, the Talmud is found guilty, and some 2 years later in 1242, some two dozen wagon loads full of manuscripts, of Hebrew manuscripts, primarily the Talmud, are burnt in Paris in June of 1242. Now let's just stop for a second. Two dozen, 24 wagon loads full of Hebrew manuscripts are incinerated in Paris. We actually know where this was. You probably were there if you ever visited Paris. So Paris has something called the City Hall, the Hôtel de Ville. It's right on the river. And there's a huge open area in front of the City Hall of Paris, a magnificent structure. And in that open air plaza, that's where they were burnt. 24 wagon loads. That's a lot of manuscripts. There's probably 1,000 manuscripts. Now understand, this is before printing. All we have are manuscripts. And you understand that it's hard to produce a manuscript. It takes a long time to produce a manuscript. How many could there have been? The vast majority of Torah texts that existed in France and, for all we know, anywhere, went up in flames. This was a tragedy, a catastrophe of monumental proportions. There are a number of Jewish as well as Christian sources that describe this event. Most striking is a report of Hillel of Verona. We're now turning to text number 5 that was written some 50 years later, a report that recently garnered a great deal of interest after the burning of part of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris in April of 2019. The context here of this particular text, written at the end of the 13th century, the context is what's known as the Maimonidean controversy. So there's this huge fight in the Jewish community. There are those who are in favor of the study of philosophy, those who are opposed to the study of philosophy. And the victim or the focus of this debate turned out to be the writings of Maimonides. So those in favor of philosophy loved the writings of Maimonides. Those who were opposed to philosophy even went so far as to burn parts of the corpus of Maimonides that they considered to be inappropriately and egregiously philosophical. And here we have Hillel of Verona in text number 5. One group found a pretext to assail the other, calling them heretics and accusing them of dealing in books of heresy. They took a number of copies of the Sefer HaMada, which is the first of the 14 books of the Code of Maimonides, known as the Mishneh Torah, which is pretty much thickly philosophical, and the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, which is the philosophical work of Maimonides. They went to France. They denounced the other group before the sages of France. They presented them. They read them. They determined their decree to burn them, and they decided that they were going to burn these books. Next paragraph, nor was this enough for them. They had all these volumes consumed by fire in broad daylight. We're talking here about the burning of the books, some of the books of Maimonides. They kindled the fire that consumed them from the great lamp that burned in the great cathedral of Paris before the altar. The priest stirred the fire, placed it upon them, and the books were burnt in the streets of Paris before an onlooking crowd. So this particular text got a lot of attention. There's now a burning in Paris, according to Hillel of Verona, and the fire for the burning of the books of Maimonides comes from a great lamp that burned in the great cathedral of Paris. And you have the Hebrew text at the bottom, at the end of the English text of text number 5. I'll read it to you in Hebrew. Od ha'esh asher ba sarfum. The fire that they used to burn it, hiv iru min haner hagadol, they took it from the great fire, shehaya doleg, that was burning, בבית הכור הקומריה הגדולה של פריז לפני המזבח. They took it from the great Comria, the great Christian cathedral, before the altar. So there was some discussion when the cathedral of Notre Dame burned. Well, is this a reference to the cathedral of Notre Dame? They actually took fire from Notre Dame to use as the flame to burn the works of Maimonides. So I was pretty skeptical. And what one needs to do, and what I started to do, was, well, when was Notre Dame built? Was there a Notre Dame around in the middle of the 13th century? The answer is yes, but there was only part of the Notre Dame around. So how much of the Notre Dame was around? Was it already used? Was there an altar? I don't know what the answer is to those questions, but what's interesting for us is Hillel of Verona's description. And he goes on to say that there was payback for the Jews because of this, because Jews were involved in getting the Christians to burn the works of Maimonides. So therefore, 40 days later, God punished them and had all the works of the Talmud burnt. And he says, in the last paragraph, and he says it was in the same place in 40 days later. And so clearly there was a punishment. Jews were so terrible in getting the church to involve themselves in the burning of the works of Maimonides. These are the ones who were opposed to philosophy, opposed to Maimonides. Hillel of Verona is in favor of Maimonides. He's appalled and aghast. What a terrible thing you did. Pay back 40 days later, in the same place, the works of the Talmud were burnt as a result of this disputation between Rabbi Yechiel of Paris and Nicholas Donin. And he has this whole poetic imagery, and I have it here, that the ashes will mix. The ashes from 40 days ago from the works of Maimonides were still there, and now they throw on all these 24 wagon loads full of Hebrew manuscripts, and the ashes are mixing, and it's a terrible thing. So it's pretty clear that Hillel of Verona is a little bit exaggerating. It's the burning of the works of Maimonides were not in Paris. They were in Montpellier. They were in southern France. So that's one little problem, that they were many miles apart. Second, there's a problem of years. The burning of the works of Maimonides were in the 1230s, at least 8 years before. So he's conflating. But it's clear that the Talmud was burnt. And this is certainly one of the sources, albeit half a century later, that describes the burning of the Talmud in Paris, the middle of the 13th century. And a fast day was established. This is particularly relevant to us because here is another example, a significant example of the establishment of a fast day. Text number 6. This is written by somebody by the name of Zedekiah ben Abraham. This is the 13th century, shortly after the event, who's living in Italy. The book he wrote is entitled Shibolei HaLeket. You have here in text number 6, the English translation, and the original below in Hebrew. The book he wrote is a kind of a code where he gives you a sense of what's going on in Jewish law about all different kinds of things. And he has a whole section about fast days. And the fast days that he discusses are the fast days of the 9th of Av and the fast days of the 10th of the 10th month and the fast day of the 17th of the fourth month. He talks about the biblically mandated fast days. And then he says, while I'm talking about fast days, let me tell you something about what happened in our time. Because we're involved with the laws of fasting, so I want to tell you what happened. 24 cartloads full of Talmud and Halachot and Haggadot. These are all different kinds of aspects of Jewish law and Jewish literature were burnt in France. And they were burnt at this particular time. He writes 1244, it's really 1242. And 4 lines from the end of the English translation, from that day on, select individuals undertook upon themselves to fast on that day each and every year. So there is a fast day. He explains why the fast day is identified by the Torah portion of the week in which it occurred rather than the date when we normally would associate a fast day. But there is a fast day that is now established to commemorate this really cataclysmic event, it's hard for us to imagine because we have printing. Imagine if your only manuscript of the Talmud is burned. Where is that going to leave you? To the best of my knowledge, we only have one complete manuscript of the Talmud from medieval times. It's known as the Munich Manuscript. We have a manuscript of this tractate, of this, but one complete? It's so elusive. It's so dangerous. It just gets burnt, and we don't have it. The whole tradition is going up in flames. It's now written down. It's not just an oral tradition. What texts am I going to consult? It's not available to me. It's monumental. And so there's a fast day. Forget about Colonimus. Forget about the 9th of Av. There's a fast day, and the fast day is established. However, it needs to be noted that first, you see the text here, select individuals. This is not something that was widely accepted. Select individuals. The Hebrew here is, and that's why I gave you the Hebrew, is yechidim. Kav'uhu, next to the last full line, yechidim. Yechidim doesn't just, yachid means one, singular, but it doesn't just mean singulars. It means special kinds of singular people. It means like prominent individuals. So on the one hand, it's not really anti-colonimus because it's some. And second of all, it's relatively local in nature because it's about French Jewry decided they were going to do this in France. France decided. So in a sense, it's local, but there is a fast day. And this is really significant because it's a fast day, albeit with all of the qualifications that are significantly important to us. The third event that I want to briefly mention is the Black Death massacres of the middle of the 14th century, from 1110 to 1242, and we're now 1347 to 1350. Text number 7 is a map that describes the spread of the plague across Europe. This was a major disaster for the Jewish community. First, it was a major disaster for Europe. Between the end of 1347 and 1350, and I'm going to say a number that it's hard even for me to say, and it's very hard to imagine, estimates have it that between a quarter and a half of the total population of Europe was wiped out during the Black Death. So I'm just going to say it one more time because it's just incomprehensible. It's beyond incomprehensible. Between a quarter and a half of the total population of those countries that were affected, Germany, France, Christian Spain, Poland, Lithuania, were destroyed in the Black Death. So it wasn't half. It was a third. It was a quarter. We're talking about massive destruction, including, of course, Jews. Jews were also killed. But Jews suffered a double tragedy, because after it was over, or even while it was going on, Jews were accused of poisoning the wells that caused the plague to happen. And so therefore, Jews got killed again. In other words, even those who survived were again victims, this time not by the plague, but by Christians who blamed them for the plague. Here again, we have evidence that a fast day was established. Very unclear. Surely local, not contradicting Colonimus, not as much as it was perceived of in the case of Blois, when you remember the England and France and the Rhineland, but there is something going on here. Here I think there's another consideration, and that is, I really don't know how many prominent rabbis were around at that time who would be in a position to establish such a fast day. You need somebody of stature after a particular event to say, you know, this is a bad thing. We ought to do something. Because a fast day is ritual. A fast day is a ritually mandated practice. You can't just do it. You have to require it. And you need somebody of significance to be able to require it. Rabbeinu Tam, allegedly the greatest rabbi of the generation, allegedly required that in the case of Blois, there should be such a fast day. The whole Jewish world was totally shattered post-Black Death for two reasons, I told you. First of all, they died in the plague, and second of all, they were killed because they were held responsible for the plague. So I think something else that needs to be factored in here is who was around to authoritatively be able to establish such a thing. We move now to our last and final tragedy, persecution, or catastrophe that I want to refer to in this presentation. 1190 York, 1242 the burning of the Talmud, 1350-ish Black Death, and now 1492. So all you have to do is say 1492, and immediately we associate with the Spanish expulsion that took place in 1492. Now, this is not the first expulsion of Jewry in Europe. Jews were expelled from England in 1290. The first national expulsion of Jews in Western Europe started in the westernmost part of Europe in 1290 in England, exactly 100 years after the York massacres. In 1305, we're now moving eastward over the Channel. 1305, Jews are expelled from France. Now, that's a big expulsion. There were little expulsions from parts of France beforehand, but 1305 is a significant expulsion. 1492, Jews are expelled from Spain. Now, but when? When in 1290 and when in 1305? So we don't know. When it comes to England, we really don't know. When it comes to France, a noted historian wrote that the evidence is inconclusive, and I quote, 22 July, around 22 July, sometime in August, 10 August, in August and September, end quote. We don't really know. We don't know for sure, but we have a Jewish source, text number 8. Lo and behold, you're not going to be shocked, but you may be surprised. Abarbanel, who was a great, great, great Jewish scholar, exegete, and rabbinic figure, lived in Spain at the end of the 15th century, who personally experienced the Spanish expulsion, wrote in one of his commentaries on a biblical text that the expulsion of the Jews from England in 1290, the expulsion of the Jews from France in 1305, happened on the 9th of Av. It happened on the 9th of Av. And he asserts it as a matter of historical fact. Text number 8. In that month, the month of Av, was decreed the decree upon the generation of the wilderness. That was the first of the five events mentioned in the Mishnah that happened on that day, that they should die there. It was the night of the 9th of Av. On that day, the first temple was destroyed. We spent a lot of time on that. On that day, the second temple was destroyed. We spent a lot of time on that. On that day was destroyed Alexandria with the great congregation of Jews that was there. That was in the first century of the Common Era. On that day, was wrought the expulsion of the island that is the end of the earth. Which island is at the end of the earth? You're writing now 1492, right? He's writing 1492 and a half. Right? The island that they're right, there's no Columbus yet, right? It's sort of, we're thinking Columbus, but there is no Columbus. So we don't know what's going on. You know, the earth ends after England and then you just fall off into oblivion somewhere, right? We don't know what's going on. The island at the end of the earth. In Hebrew, it's called E Kitzei Haaretz. E means island, Kitzei at the edge of the earth. Jews are expelled from the island at the edge of the earth, which is called Inglaterra, on that day. What day? The 9th of Av. On that day, it continues, was wrought the expulsion from France in the year 1305. So I don't know. I'm a little bit skeptical. I mean, I try to be a believing Jew, but, it's a little bit too suspect for me. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. Now, he's not saying, must have been on that day, as we have seen in the context of the second temple destroyed. You know, bad things happen on bad days, so I don't know when it happened, but it must have happened. He doesn't even frame it that way. He frames it as a statement of fact. This happened on that day, and this happened on that day, and this happened on that day. There is no zero evidence, certainly in the case of England. We have no idea when it happened. This is the only source. Cecil Roth, who was a very prominent British historian, Jewish historian, published an article The date of the expulsion of the Jews from England in 1290 was the 9th of Av, and he quotes Abarbanel as his source, and we're good to go. We're good to go, we're not good to go, but clearly, now we understand it, and I think appreciate it in the context of our discussion, the 9th of Av is ginormous, huge. So this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And he continues that this was also the date in 1492 of the Spanish expulsion. Continue reading, and what shall I add? A couple of lines, two lines later. And what shall I add? This happened, this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened on Tisha B'Av, and this happened, and this happened. Uma osif od ledaber. You could see him sitting there or standing there and throwing up his hands. And what more can I say? For behold, when the king of Spain decreed banishment for all the Jews that were in all of his dominions, that they should go forth within 3 months, the time ended and the day of departure fell on the 9th of Av. The last day that a Jew, professing Jew, could live in Spain was on the 9th of Av. Now understand, Jews were not expelled on one day. We're going to come to this in a moment. Jews were told that they have to leave in 3 months from now. The end of that three-month period was, according to Abarbanel, the 9th of Av. He was there. He worked very hard. He was a courtier in the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, worked very hard to try to stave off the edict of expulsion, was unsuccessful. He himself was expelled. And he tells us that it happened on the 9th of Av. In text number 9, I brought you some of the drama of his efforts to try to work as much as he could to make sure that there should not be an edict of expulsion, but regretfully, he was not successful. The edict of expulsion, text number 10, concludes with the following. Now, he already mentioned it, Abarbanel, the Jews were given 3 months to leave. It was written by Ferdinand and Isabella and signed on the 31st day of the month of March. Now, this was signed in the town of Granada, in the city of Granada. Granada, I'm assuming some of you have been to Granada, is the southern part of Spain. Granada is most famous for the Alhambra Palace, which is a just jaw-droppingly, magnificently, incredibly beautiful example of Moorish architecture and culture. And if you go to the Alhambra Palace in Granada and you go to the Hall of the Ambassadors, there's a big, huge room in the palace, in the Alhambra Palace in Granada. It is in that room where the Edict of Expulsion was signed. For all kinds of reasons, Ferdinand and Isabella are in Granada. In 1492 is when they're pushing out the Muslims, the last little stronghold of Islamic power in Spain was in Granada. They pushed them out. They destroyed the last vestige of Islam. And then they turned their attention to the Jews. So they were already in Granada leading the fight against the Muslims. And in that room, they signed the Edict of Expulsion. I've been in that room more than once. I travel with American Jews and I show them the history of Europe. I was with them in front of the Hotel de Ville in Paris and many other places. And I read the Edict of Expulsion in that room. It looks exactly today the way it looked then. The room is exactly the same wall, the same floor, exactly the same. And you imagine Ferdinand and Isabella sitting at the table. And they're signing the Edict of Expulsion, and it is signed on the 31st of March, and it gives Jews 3 months to leave, which means they have April, May, and June. Abarbanel went to work. Others went to work. They pushed it off for a month. The clock started to tick a month later, and so the 3 months ended not at the end of June, but ended at the month of July. In text number 11, I show you proof that it was not the last day of July in 1492 was not the 9th of Av. I mean, that's verifiable. You can figure out exactly when that was, but it was the 7th of the month of Av. This comes from Yitzhak Ber, one of the most prominent Jewish historians of Christian Spain. The Jews had, text number 11, had to leave Spain within 3 months after the promulgation of the Edict of Expulsion. On July 31st, a couple of lines later, parenthesis, the 7th of Av, the last Jew left the soil of Spain. Next sentence, according to a legendary report, among the first to give it currency was our Abarbanel. All the Jews left Spain, quote, on a single day, the 9th of Av. This is nothing but a fable invented in the bright light of history. In other words, it wasn't the 9th of Av. On the anniversary of the destruction of the temple, namely on the 9th of Av, this is clear. All the Jews of Spain were either wandering outside its borders on land and sea, or those who decided to stay, but they were given a choice. If you want to convert to Christianity, you could stay. Here, the choice was not conversion or death. Here, the choice was conversion or expulsion. So those who left, left. Those who stayed, any Jew who stayed, who was in Spain on August 1st of 1492, by definition, was identifying himself or herself as a Christian. So at that day, either the Jews were out or were confined in the dungeons of the Inquisition and bound by the fetters of an alien faith which had been forced upon them. And then there's this long footnote that it happened on the 7th of Av. I have to tell you, you know what? I'll hand it to him. You know what? 7th of Av, close enough for me. 7th of Av, 9th of Av, not going to hold him to it. It's fine. Clearly, the 9th of Av is something that looms so large. And, you know, we'll excuse him his excess of sort of pushing the extra 2 days. There's no fast day for the commemoration of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Massive, massive upheaval. And the answer to me is obvious. And it brings us back to what I was thinking about earlier in the case of York. Namely, there is a fast day. And the fast day for the expulsion of the Jews from Spain is the 9th of Av. And if one looks at the ritual service of Spanish and Portuguese communities on the 9th of Av, there are multiple references to the Spanish expulsion. In the Ashkenazi community, in the book of the Ashkenazi community's recital for the 9th of Av, parenthesis, comma, regretfully, sad for me, there is no reference to the Spanish expulsion. I actually say something on the 9th of Av personally, commemorating the Spanish expulsion, because this is a big deal for the Jewish people. You know, it's a sign of sort of this ethnic, you know, like that was them and not us, and that's us and not them. But for Spanish Jews, this is cataclysmic. The reason why there's no fast day is because there is a fast day. And I think that's why there was no fast day in the case of York, not because there already was a fast day, but because the day wasn't appropriate for a fast day. So we need to take into consideration who's around to establish a fast day. We need to take into consideration when the event happened. We need to take into consideration, is it national? Is it local? Is it individual? Is it more public? There is clear evidence that many, many fast days were established in subsequent centuries. I talked about from 1190 to 1492. Throughout the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries, there are new fast days established. We have evidence in Frankfurt, in Prague, in Krakow, in Metz, in Mainz, in Worms, and elsewhere. No national fast days, but many local fast days. The most famous persecution that occurred in the 17th century that did, lo and behold, result in a national fast day is the Chmelnytsky massacres of 1648 and 1649, and it is to these massacres that I will turn our attention in my next presentation. But the Chmelnytsky massacres lasted for a year and a half. First round from the middle of 1648 through the end of 1649. What criteria am I going to use to determine this day is more appropriate than that day?